Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for CEO Exclusive, brought to you by Annona Enterprises.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to CEO Exclusive, where we get emerging trends from CEOs and their most trusted advisors. On today's show, we have Tom O'Brien and Dr. Jim Ross from Axion Biosystems. I'm going to talk to them a little bit today about some cutting-edge technology, biotechnology that they have, and how they were able to leverage that technology, grow quickly, and get on the 100 fastest-growing companies in the city of Atlanta. So welcome, guys. Glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Eleni. It's good to be here.
Yeah, likewise. Great to be here.
So as always, I start the show by asking, from your area of expertise, what are the trends that you think are important for other CEOs to know about?
As it relates to our business, I think the two trends for us. Atlanta's been a great place to start a business. We got a lot of help at the beginning from the Georgia Research Alliance. So for us, it's been fantastic to be in Atlanta and have access to also to Georgia Tech facilities. And I think for us, the big trend has been the rapid growth in stem cell technology. And that's what our device is used for. And it's really helped with our growth over the past 8 years.
And so, Jim, I know that Tom came to you when he was looking for a technology that he wanted to commercialize. Tell us a little bit about the technology and the device that you guys have invented and marketed.
So in grad school, my colleagues and I were working on a technology that would allow us to get deeper insight into brain and heart activity in ways that could scale to industrial platforms. So we developed a tool that allows us to interface the stem cells that Tom is referring to and, in essence, collect heartbeats and brain activity, but instead of in the body, collect that activity in a dish. And by collecting it in a dish, we can scale it, we can study it faster, and we can get deeper insights in a dish that you couldn't do inside an animal or a body.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what are the business implications of this technology, and why do you think it's so important? Stem cells have been in the press a lot, and there's been some controversy about them, but why do you think that this is an important business application?
So for a couple of reasons. Actually, when we started the business in 2008, one big trend was the desire to move away from animal studies. So it's called toxicity in the 21st century in the United States, and it's called REACH in Europe, but there's actually a movement and legislation to move away from testing animals. So that played right into what we were developing, a device that would replace animal studies with cells, whether they're animal cells or now the growth in induced pluripotent stem cells since 2007 has really was the trend that really helped us. So it's moving away from animals has been big for us.
So you used a big word, induced pluripotent stem cells. You mind telling us what that is, Jim?
It's known in the business primarily as adult stem cell technology. So it's the capability to take skin cells or blood cells and directly derive a person's cells from that. So what you can do is take, for example, we could take your blood and roll it back into a more primitive state and then direct it into any cell type in your body that actually has your genetic fingerprint, such that we have your brain cell or your heart cell. This has a number of advantages. One, it's a human cell, but two, it also has your genetic fingerprint, which leads towards patient-specific applications. So if someone's unfortunate enough to have a disease, we can rep and has a genetic background or a genetic fingerprint to it. We can recreate cells that have that disease latent inside of that cell.
So just another comment on that is this was really big because you may recall the controversy over embryonic stem cells.
Correct.
This completely erases all of that because it's non-embryonic.
So you're getting these stem cells from adults.
So we don't get the stem cells. So there's two ways to do this. So if you look at, there's commercial companies, public companies now that create these stem cell lines, such as Cellular Dynamics and Axiogenesis. So they create a cell line that's consistent and researchers can use to test drugs, for example. And then there's academics primarily that derive cells to test the genetic fingerprints that Jim was talking about. So they're specific to patients as opposed to a cell line that can be sold commercially, consistent, and used by people all over the world.
And so your technology, what is it actually? What do you actually sell?
So we sell systems and consumables. The system allows us to take measurements from these human cells, and the consumables what's actually physically interfaces those cells and where the signal begins. So and it actually allows us to collect ECG-like signals in a dish. So if you're familiar with ECG signals in the clinic and the doctor's office, you see blips that represent the heartbeat. Our instrument captures that same kind of signal with beating human cardiomyocytes. So inside these culture dishes, you'll have human cells. They'll physically beat. You can see them beating. And our instrument is detecting its electrical activity, just like a doctor would detect the electrical activity of a heart in the clinic.
Mm-hmm. And so you sell the Petri dish?
We sell the culture plate or the Petri dish and the system. So you culture the cells inside the Petri dish. It's a smart culture dish of sorts. And since that we have sensors embedded in the bottom of this dish that pick up that activity, just like a doctor put leads on your body to pick up the ECG, our culture dish has little mini micro-sized sensors in the bottom that pick up that activity.
And so you're saying cells have a heartbeat. I mean, obviously they don't have a heart, but they have these electric signals that you can measure?
Exactly.
And are the results that you get from them as good as if you were testing mice or testing people?
Oftentimes they're better than animals. So animals aren't very predictive. And so that means that you can study a toxic effect in an animal that shows toxicity in the animal, but it's safe in the human, and then vice versa, where a compound will show safety in an animal, but it gets to the human. In many cases, the animals do not predict what's going to happen in the human. And fortunately, to the other side of your question, is very predictive of what happens in the clinic. So we see the same kinds of signal changes in the dish as you do in the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. And even more interesting is if it's patient-specific, if it's a patient with a particular heart condition, this cell technology and this device captures that symptom in a dish, and you can observe the same changes to that symptom and even figure out how to correct it in the dish before you apply it to the person.
So you could literally start to develop therapies and treatment on a patient-by-patient basis because you would get that person's own blood and kind of break it down?
Exactly. So Tom had highlighted the initial phase of this technology where it's most commercially used now is for research, where we study how compounds affect the cells. I think Tom was alluding to the fact, too, that it goes further towards patient-specific therapies, and then also another category of regenerative medicine where you're not using the cells to understand what they do, but using the cells to actually fix the human condition, using the cells as the drug.
Oh, okay. So when you say regenerative, this is helping to fix things, as you said.
Exactly.
So, if I can, I'd like to go back to a reference that you made to a Petri dish. And I think a Petri dish implies a single well. And what's differentiated Axion completely from anyone is the device that Jim and his colleagues created at Georgia Tech, where we have a multi-well plate where you can do 96 samples at a time as opposed to one, because the technology we've had has been around for a couple of decades in the Petri dish type format, and you can't get any throughput. It's not scalable. What we've created is a product that's scalable, soon to be automated, and it has a lot of add-on features to it that are useful to both pharmaceutical, biotech, academia, government uses.
I think what you're saying is with the 96 Petri dishes, you can run 96 different experiments at the same time.
Exactly. It's like having 96 mice, except you're doing it in a Petri dish with human cells. In a multi-well formatted plate that's standard to the industry with human cells.
So who are your customers?
So it's really large pharmaceutical companies, so GlaxoSmithKline, BMS. You've got biotech such as Genentech. You've got academia, Harvard, Yale, Stanford all have our systems, et cetera. And government, EPA and the FDA use our system on a daily basis.
And so you said that you started the company in 2008.
We did.
That was a very interesting time, I imagine, to start a company.
Yeah, it was, we like challenges. So we picked a time to be challenged.
How did you guys meet and start the company?
So the genesis was in 2003, and I was asked to be on the Biomedical Engineering Advisory Board at Georgia Tech. And as part of the process of coming down and evaluating, they gave me a tour of the lab, and they happened to pair me with Jim. And Jim showed me around the lab in 2003, shook hands, went my merry way, and he was beginning his graduate studies. So flash forward to 2007, I had was part of a team that sold a public business and was looking for my next thing to do. And so the GRA invited me down to look at, the Georgia Research Alliance invited me down to look at companies at Georgia Tech, Emory, and University of Georgia. And one of the companies that I spoke with was the one that Jim wanted to start. And so I like the technology, the fact that he had pre-funding from the National Institutes of Health. And then we started to license the product. And in May of 2008, we started the business.
Wow. And so, Jim, how did you, when you were thinking about who to choose to help you commercialize your idea, how did you go about thinking through that process? What were the attributes that you were looking for, and how did you know that Tom was going to be a match?
You know, I don't think we actually gave it much thought about, and I think at the time we didn't realize how important having business experience was. What instantly attracted us to Tom is that he came in with a certain clearness and discipline and force and experience, communicated to us his value, what we needed to get this going. And we were just, it sounds strange, but swept off our feet a little bit. It hadn't really pondered what it actually meant to get a business up and running. We thought the technology was fun. The idea of starting a company was fun. It was really initially, I would say almost a collision of two different worlds that have come together in a way that works very well for the business today.
And what about you, Tom? What were you looking for, and how did you know that Jim was going to be a match for you?
So I've always fantasized about starting a company, and for my entire career was with large companies. And it was just Jim had a compelling reason to join the company. I mean, the technology was interesting. He's a very, very convincing guy, and it just seemed like it would be a fun thing to do. So honestly, it was just really just the luck of time that we ran into each other. So timing is right.
Yeah. And so when in 2008 did you guys decide to start the company?
So we actually decided in November of 2007, and Jim was just finishing his PhD, hadn't defended his thesis yet, and I was working on licensing the technology from Georgia Tech. So very spotty interaction between November and I guess probably early 2008, and then you defended like May 1st, and we started the company May 8th.
Okay.
May 8th was the date we started.
Okay. So what were you doing around October 2008? So what was happening in your world around October?
So we were in pretty good shape at the beginning, because really we had it was the two of us in an office at Georgia Tech, and we had one in the middle of the summer. We had hired one part-time employee, and it was entirely funded by the NIH grant that Jim had.
And Jim, how much was that grant?
The initial phase one small business grant was $350,000.
Okay.
And we had another $100,000 in support from the state of Georgia through the Georgia Research Alliance. So we had funding so that, you know, Jim had a salary, and the part-time employee had a salary, and we were able to pay for supplies and office. And really, we were both trying to figure out whether this was a business, whether we had a product, what we could do. And I think, so when we raised money for the first time in March 2009, and so, you know, another great time. And
but we began our solicitation in October while the market was crashing in New York.
So how did that go?
So it actually,
that's pretty, that's you must have been like the only company in, you know, when you're looking at those numbers and they had like nine companies who were able to raise money in 2008, you were like one of the nine companies.
So we were fortunate. The company that I was part of beforehand, we had a successful exit, and people were interested in investing in some alternative technologies. And so we had good connections, and so we've had three rounds of funding. That's all public information. You know, the first was, you know, a little over a million, a little over 2 million, then a little over 3 million. And it's all been with the same investors. So there we have, you know, loyal and patient investors, and it's worked out really well for us. So they liked what we had to offer. We're talking today about our first product, but we've also been funded by the NIH for two additional completely different product lines in different markets, all focused around mostly managing and manipulating the brain.
Mm-hmm. And so when you were having these conversations in 2008, were your investors skittish at all?
So
I mean, the whole world was the whole world was coming to an end.
They seemed uncomfortably amused. I think it was a great icebreaker and a joke at how fast the market was falling. I think we were there on the third or second consecutive day of 20% drops.
Yeah, and but it's three more days till it's at zero.
Yeah.
So look, the people we're working with, have the means and like the idea, and they're looking to make a bunch of money off of a potential exit, no matter how we do it. So, and like I said, they've been loyal and consistent in their support of Axion.
Yeah, I think they had a great deal of faith, particularly in Tom and now our board chairman, Glenn, his former colleague at Intermagnetics. So I think their past performance in a public company actually gave the investors a lot of confidence that this cohort could do it again, and even in a completely different context.
Right. And so, after you raised your first round in March of 2009, you said, I think it was $1 million.
Right.
So you had $1.3 million at that point. And so how did your growth go from there?
So believe it or not, I have to say I was pretty naive at that point about how much we would need. I think we both were. We assumed that the $1 million would get us to a commercial product and ready, and that we would be growing rapidly from the start. And it was a little bit different. So anybody who's trying to raise money, I would say raise two or three times what you think you need, and you'd be much better off. But we thought we would grow much more quickly than we did at the start, and so that's why it's taken a couple more rounds. But what it allowed us to do is to build out our infrastructure, add several more, I guess a couple more PhD level, but other R&D people in R&D to begin developing our software, some of our consumables, and to finish up with the platform.
And I guess for me, as we talk about this, the funding story, because that's a big deal. How did you not lose credibility with your investors when you had to come back to them and say, hey, listen, I'm sorry, I didn't ask for enough the first time.
And we did it twice. So, they believed in what we could accomplish. And so I think we were fortunate, again, that we have it's all what people would consider friends and family round. And they've understood the story. By the third time we raised money, we were moving it well into the right direction. So they had confidence that this was really for growth as opposed to, just proving that we could do it. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, the technology was advancing, as was our understanding of it, and the markets were maturing around it too. So the promise of what we were working on was becoming more and more apparent, despite the fact that we were behind on our execution of the initial product.
And so are these investors folks who know the industry and are familiar with the technology?
No. No, for the most part, there are some, yes, but for the most part, they, as Jim said, they basically have confidence in the team that we've put together, and that's what they're betting on. And I think, at this point, we're, and I'm saying this because I think it's probably a pretty good thing. We're about a year behind our initial business plan, which we're catching up rapidly.
So, by the time you had the third round, did you have these marquee name customers signed as well?
Yeah. So we started, by the time we were raising money, we had gotten into our first pharmaceutical company, which was a huge deal for us. And we were beginning.
Is that round one or round three?
Three.
Okay. By the time you were in round three.
We haven't raised money since March of 2012. So we haven't raised money in 3 years.
Okay.
And that was the last time. And we still have the majority, not the majority, but 2/3 of that money still on our balance sheet. So we've been growing enough to sustain the business between revenues and also additional NIH funds.
And so who does the selling? Because it sounds to me like the research, obviously the research and the technology is really strong, but then it sounds like you must have a really strong sales operations too to be able to hook these whales.
So yeah. I'm going to contrast now to 2011, 10 and 11, when Jim and I were on the phone practically begging people to try. And then we've hired a very professional team that now sells for us in the United States. So we have a global director of sales and marketing, We have currently have two direct sales people. We're going to add a third, and we've got beginning to have global distribution. So we have all of Europe covered, Japan, China, India, Taiwan, so the big countries. So we've been assembling that really over the past 2 years, and that's dramatically helped our growth.
Mm-hmm. Was that always a part of the business plan? Did you say at some point, okay, we have to get somebody who can sell for us because we can't do it?
Oh, no, it was always part of the business. To have our own sales force?
Yeah.
Yeah, always part of the business plan in the United States. And we're, just from my experience, sales force is expensive. And so we wanted to afford it in the United States, and we decided that it's in our best interest to start with distribution outside the United States, because we use the analogy, you know, foot on the gas, foot on the brake. So we've got to really manage our operating cash flow, and to add a sales force, you know, we would have had to raise more money, and it just didn't make sense for us.
Mm. So as you look back over the past 7 years, what are some of the mistakes that you've made, and you know, how would you tell people to do things differently, Jim?
Yeah, I think I mentioned in the beginning, and Tom spoke to this a little bit too, both of us are a bit naive about what it would take to start a company. So we had a lot of energy and enthusiasm, and came from two very different organizations with very different kinds of thoughts. So I came from a grad school environment that was very free-spirited, creative. Tom came from public company where there's a lot of structure and discipline. And when those two things met in the beginning, along with a mix of naive understanding of what it was going to take to start the company, it was a challenge actually to reconcile our views of the world with the reality. But once we did that, it became quite a fun operation. So I think initially, as Tom mentioned, we underestimated how much money it would take. I had to come to understand very obvious things in hindsight, like the difference between a prototype and a product, and also things that are not necessarily technologically risky. Those things don't mean that they're fast to implement. So from a grad school perspective, you're always focused on what's novel or what's difficult. So I made some poor assumptions about things that weren't novel or difficult, but actually very challenging to implement. So does that make sense?
Well, could you give us an example?
One is software. So the core technology that we developed is in the hardware and in the microsensors. And we worked out a lot of complex problems to be able to interface sensors to cells and to develop hardware that could facilitate that. And our thought at the time was, well, now we just glue it together with software. And it really came to appreciate how complicated and how enabling actually software could be. So that was an example where we underestimated the effort by easily 18 months of what it was going to take to get the software to catch up with the core technology.
Hmm. I think just another thing is that neither one of us had any experience in the life science tools industry. And I think what we made up for in lack of experience, we had plenty of confidence. And so, so we had to wade through it. And you know, both of us are pretty determined guys and resourceful. And so getting to the right people and getting an understanding of it, we managed. But it took longer, and it would have been nice to have access to someone that had the experience in this business to be able to say, this is the right direction. Maybe you want to think about this. Here's the wrong direction. So I think that played a role in us being a little bit slower to market than we should have been.
Mm-hmm. So let's say, you know, you're going to commercialize your next business. What are you going to do next time to make sure that you get the assumptions right in the beginning?
Raise a lot more money to start.
I think we'd think more about the end too, and the market, and the customers that we're servicing. And also, one of the things we've tremendously benefited from is establishing a network with partner companies and collaborators. So actually, getting connected with stem cell suppliers really changed everything for us in the beginning. So actually identifying where the industry interest was and how that related to our product, and having those peers and friends and colleagues in similar businesses really helped change things around for the appeal of our product and how it was used.
We looked at this a little bit upside down, is that at the beginning, is you need to be able to measure electrophysiology, and people wanted to move away from animals. So, of course, everyone's going to want, and you need throughput. So, of course, everyone's going to want to buy our system. It turns out that, you know, 8 years later, that's becoming true, but it took a while to get connected and help people understand why our product was so important and enabling for them.
And so was it that you were kind of enamored of the technology and didn't validate your market demand early enough?
Probably some of that. Yes.
Okay.
Look, it's hard to predict and estimate a market that we're essentially developing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no high throughput microelectroarray system when we started, and today there's really no, you know, competition.
So the high throughput is the fact that you can do 96 at the same time.
Right.
Okay.
And because it just, not, sorry to interrupt, we have such a dense electrogeometry that we can actually go to 384 well plates and still offer value to customers evaluating, you know, cardiac cells. So we still have plenty of room to grow, and it's really something that to date can't be replicated.
What are your patents for?
So it's for those core technology pieces that we were talking about, that hardware that enables these applications and also the microsensors that interface to the cells. And then we have a portfolio of patents and process that are around the applications, along with also taking those two core pieces, that hardware and those microsensors, and applying them for medical devices and implantables in the body.
Mm-hmm. And so as a strategist, one of the things that I'm always really interested in is, did you guys have a business plan when you started?
Not when we started, but we began it shortly thereafter. So we started the business with a plan on a one page of paper.
Yeah, a napkin.
Right. And honestly, we had the funding from the NIH and the funding from the Georgia Research Alliance were designed to help us see whether we could develop a prototype that worked.
Yeah, de-risking the technology.
Right. Mm-hmm. And once we saw that we could de-risk it and develop a commercial product, that's when we began. We weren't going to raise any money at all until we knew that this was we could make this a going concern.
Right. For folks who are not in the industry, what does de-risk mean?
It means, in short, that we could build a product that people would buy. And so when in May of 2008, that was not clear.
From a technology perspective, you can identify the key parts of the technology that are likely or possible to fail. You can bring those up to the front of the process and make sure that those aspects don't fail, that those pieces are successful. And if they are, then it becomes a matter of just implementation. and that's part of where that naive aspect that we spoke to earlier, where we assumed we were past the risky stages and then didn't appreciate how much discipline and money and energy it would take to actually create a product around this exciting technology.
Mm-hmm. So did you find value in doing the business plan? Because one of the things that I find with some of my clients is that, you know, they're so busy running the business that they don't necessarily want to take the time that it takes to plan effectively. So, I mean, did you find it valuable, and how important was it to you in achieving the success you've achieved?
So it was critical for us, because we would not have been able to raise money without a business plan, for starters, and without the money, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
But it also gave us the discipline to think about what are our priorities within what we're capable of developing, because we have three product lines. We've gone with the one that didn't need any FDA regulation first, and that's gone well, and we're working on the other two. But it helped us to say, this is what we want to accomplish first. This is kind of our target for revenues and what we want to do in terms of profitability, planning for people. What are we going to invest in terms of R&D and operations and sales? So it was an important piece of staying disciplined for us. And as Jim mentioned, that's my background, is trying to figure out how to, you know, make sure we do what we say we're going to do, and, you know, narrow down what we trying to accomplish rather than trying to solve all the problems at once.
Yeah. And it's fairly common, you know, that folks will write a business plan when they want to raise money, right? Cause that's the urgency. Do you still do business planning, and do you still find value from it?
So we're in the process. So our company has evolved so much since 2008, and we're on the same trajectory and in the same market, but stem cells have really changed how we think about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the process of updating our business plan, just because it's time to think about, you know, really what are our next steps. We're not actively raising money. We don't really need to, but it's how big do we want to be? How fast do we want to grow? And if we want to do that, there's got to be a discipline around saying what could be, right? So we feel like we have our first product line is absolutely going in the right direction. Is what can we add by these other two product lines, and do we invest in those, basically developing separate groups for them? And you know, how would we do that? And that would require a business plan.
Great. And one question I have, you know, as you look at the growth over the past 7 years, you guys have gotten onto the Atlanta Business Chronicle's Pacesetter list, one of the fastest 100 growing companies in the city. What are the key things that you think helped you achieve that growth? I mean, obviously having a completely, you know, novel technology that has no competition, obviously must be helpful. But what are the other things that you think really contributed to achieving that level of success?
I think it's the combination of growing a professional sales organization along with some things that have changed in the regulatory environment that have brought some attention to our platform as well. So both the Environmental Protection Agency and the FDA are very interested in capturing human complexity in a dish so that they can understand the safety effects of household chemicals or pharmaceuticals in a way that they can scale and get a very, what they would call, comprehensive view of the safety. And so that has motivated toxicity in the 21st century from the EPA, which is a move to reduce and eventually, in very long time periods, replace animal testing. And the FDA is now moving towards a regulated requirement that all drugs would have to be assessed using potentially cardiomyocytes and our technology to understand the safety effects of drugs.
Yeah, cardiomyocytes are heart cells?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I would add one other thing. Really, our growth is based upon having a great team. And at the beginning, it's not, you know, you don't necessarily assemble all the right people. But I think we've learned how to attract very, very good people, excellent people, and how to determine during the interview process whether they'll be a good fit. And so we've assembled a phenomenal team. And I think that that's really the fundamental reason we've grown and done so well and created this fantastic product.
Yeah, I think it's really true. We couldn't have taken advantage of those opportunities that emerged from the market without the team that we have now.
And so, I mean, at this point, that's almost cliche, right? Like, you know, you got to have a great team. Everybody knows you got to have a great team. So talk to us a little bit about what that process looks like. Like, how do you go about picking the gems?
Let me just say, so one is we learned through mistakes at the start. So we had a kind of a profile of what didn't work. And then now anybody who comes in for a job interview, no matter what level, they're required to make a presentation about what they've done in the past or a particular problem with their PhD, what they did their thesis on, present it to, you know, 8 or 9 people in the company, and then go through and defend what they've done and answer questions. And then they go through, you know, an interview process to see whether they're going to fit and how they're going to fit.
So we try to identify people that are very objective focused. So meaning that they're not very defensive. They're very focused on what you're trying to achieve. People are very bright and smart, but they're not sensitive. So we're looking for an entire team of people that can communicate very directly and candidly about company problems, not take it personally, but also applying all their talents and all their intelligence towards helping to solve that problem. And that combination, when you get a large number of people in the company that possess both great deal of intelligence and that are also very objective focused and not at all defensive, it's fun. It's exciting how fast you can create and how much the company can grow.
Yeah, and look, I make plenty of mistakes and I make decisions that may lead us in the wrong direction. So we need people with enough confidence to be able to say, hey, Tom, this is the wrong thing and here are the 5 reasons, and rather than sit back. So we need a team that understands that we all have the same objective. And if any one of us is taking us off that objective, you need to understand why and have a debate about it.
So that's another balance we're trying to strike between team members that will take direction but also challenge at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so we now have a culture and a team that it feels very comfortable challenging, but we all get on the same page. One of our early lessons was learning that rowing in the wrong direction was actually better than rowing in two different directions, because we could course correct and also have an environment that wasn't a lot of people that were just saying yes, but that would challenge, and find that that harmony between all these different opposites has really created a fun team.
And so do you guys use some sort of a personality assessment as well, or no?
No.
Instinct, no. I think, and also the contrast, like Tom said, knowing personality traits that didn't work in the past. And so the team now is very focused and protective. And that's been fun to watch, actually, that the team now is as rigorous, if not more, than Tom and I about who comes into the company. They're very critical.
Right. So you were going to say something, Tom, when I asked about the assessment.
No, we don't do a personality assessment. We've just finished. We use a firm, a PPO called Insperity. And they've got a broad range of services. It's really been a big step up for us in terms of outsourcing HR, which we had basically zero HR before 2014. And now they've really been a nice partner. And they just conducted a climate survey for us. And I would say for the most part, it came back very, very good. There are areas that we need to improve, and we'll go through it with the entire company tomorrow and say, here's where we're good. Here's where you're telling us we need to make some changes. Here are the changes we can make. Here are some reasons maybe we can't make them, but we're in a constant evaluation of how we're performing. Cause I sincerely mean it that we have a fantastic team and we wouldn't want to lose anybody. So we need to figure out ways to adjust, as we go along.
I think one of the tools we've brought over from the sciences is this constant peer review process and critique. And so whether it's a business operation or a technology development, all members of the team are constantly trying to figure out how can we make it better, what's working and what's not working.
Mm-hmm. And do you bring that kind of review process to your HR as well? Do you constantly do evaluations and check-ins and things like that?
So we're fairly formal about that. So every year, I don't know if this is common for small companies, but we have reviews, and we've had that almost since the beginning, probably since 2009 or 2010. And we have common periods where people get their increases and the reviews have to be in before then. So we do everything on July 1, but we do go through reviews. We have goals and objectives that are set, and they're normally evaluated at least mid-year. But, you know, some groups do them more often, and some, you know, groups wait till the end of the year. But yeah, we do have a formal review process and set goals and objectives for the company and for individuals.
But also a lot of the critiques and feedback, though, are continuous. They're happening all the time with regard to the goals and the objectives that we're trying to meet. So those are established early, but even those get questioned, and whether we need to do a course correction, that happens every day.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the underlying market conditions, some change in regulation in your team as the three biggest things that you think have contributed to helping you achieve that fast growth. Was there anything else?
No, the team. And Jim started to go down the path of the sales team. We hired a great guy to lead the team who has a lot of experience in this industry. Mm. In fact, we tried to hire him in 2009, and he turned us down, and then a few years later he decided to come with us, and it's been very good. So adding a professional sales team has really changed the landscape for us as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'll just shift the conversation to asking, is there anything, like any new services you mentioned, I think some expansion, but anything else that you think would be interesting that's happening at Axion Biosystems that you think our listeners want to know about the company?
I think on the technology side, now it's an exciting time for expanding the product. So the Maestro platform, this is the system that we sell that reads these electrical signals from cells, is very much a platform in the sense that with software we can change how it reads the cells or what it's reading, what kind of information. So we're doing a lot now to further automate, enable new kinds of readings from the cells, and new modes of control. So it's getting quite interesting in the sense that we can not only capture complex brain activity, now we're developing tools that can control the brain activity at the same time, giving us deeper insight and allowing our customers to go deeper into different kinds of brain diseases or safety issues.
Yeah, and so we're adding an automation platform that'll be out this fall, where optogenetics is a big new field in neuroscience and a little bit in cardiac, but we'll have a tool that can be used on the Maestro so that you can control brain cells and heart cells with light. I think the next product line, which is more of a medical device or diagnostic tool for nerve conduction studies, is in process and supported by the NIH, and we're probably 2 years away from commercializing that. As you may have heard, GlaxoSmithKline is a huge pharmaceutical company that's investing in something called bioelectronic medicine. And what they want to do is take control of the peripheral nerves. And so we develop these microsensors that can be implanted in the body that can be useful for that market as well. So we're involved in really dynamic and growing markets. And so while our core focus and our primary focus is our microelectrode array technology, we have, you know, we have other pieces to this puzzle that can we really can grow rapidly.
We're also in the process of these retrospective studies where we take the technology and go use it to ask a question about whether or not it could have caught something that was fatal or dangerous. This is both to attempt the power of the technology and also help with human health issues. There have been a couple of case studies now they're working on where, in fact, drugs that were acquired for over $1 billion by large pharmaceutical companies that failed in clinical trials because they resulted either in fatality or hospitalizations are actually detected much earlier with that combination of human heart cells in our system.
Awesome. Well, this is very, very exciting, and it's been delightful having you on the show. If folks want to get in touch with you to hear to talk to you more about stuff that they've heard on the show, how can they do that?
So they can reach us through the website, and our phone number is there, and our contact information is there as well.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Sonia.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
This show is brought to you by Annona Enterprises, where strategy is your access to money and performance. Learn more at annonaenterprises.com.